Welcome to the GoTo Podcast. Each episode covers the brightest and boldest ideas from the world's leading experts in software development. Tune in for practical lessons, compelling theories, and plenty of inspiration. GoTo gathers the brightest minds in the software community to help developers tackle projects today, plan for tomorrow, and create a better future. Stay up to date with the latest in tech through GoTo's top-rated events held online and in person in cities like Amsterdam, London, Copenhagen, and Chicago, and by subscribing to the GoTo Conferences YouTube channel, where you can find thousands more high-quality dev talks. Learn more at gotopia.tech.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this new summer episode of the GoTo Book Club. I'm Xin, calling in from Copenhagen, Denmark, and I'll be your host today. And it's a great joy to be joined by my two friends, these two wonderful guests from the beautiful and delicious Italy.
Yeah, thank you.
Alessandro Colla and Alberto Acibis. They are the authors of this new book called Domain-Driven Refactoring, a hands-on DDD guide to transforming monoliths to modular systems and microservices. And I've had the pleasure of writing the foreword to their book. So, Alessandro, Alberto, so great to have you here.
Thank you.
Both of your names start with the letter A.
Yeah.
And for me, you two are kind of like these top grade AA batteries full of energy and power. So
nice,
the plan today is kind of to bring your personal energy and of course also some of the most powerful insights from your new book into this conversation. Are you all charged?
Yes.
Yes.
Great. Let's dive in. Yes, good to have you here. So why don't we start with your personal stories? Maybe I could ask each of you to briefly introduce yourselves and in particular your journey into domain-driven design.
Okay, I will start. Hi all, I'm Alessandro, of course. I started with domain-driven design, I think, a bit late. It was 2010, 2012. I discovered domain-driven design. Couple of years later, I think I did all the possible mistakes using in the wrong way domain-driven design. So I learned a lot. And right now, I am till now searching for the truth, still looking for the truth because everything changes. You discover something new every time. And I am lucky enough to have to work on different domain. And so I made a lot of experience. My company, I work for Evoluzione, it's a company that develop mainly e-commerce solutions from scratch of complex systems. And domain-driven design had helped me a lot in finding solutions and being able to deliver value to the customer. And that's it.
Thank you, Alessandro.
I am Alberto, of course. when Alessandro was talking about this history, I think my journey with domain-driven design began more or less 50 years ago, Ale, with you, when I first met Alessandro during a local community meetup. At the time, the only books that were available were the iconic blue book of Vernon, the Red Day of Evans, the red book of Vernon, and an amazing book, Jimmy Nielsen, that for the first time, finally, showed me how to write domain-driven design, how to move all fantastic, amazing patterns, theories, and so on in a real world, and especially in .NET and C#. And at the time, I started to use that framework. And so, finally, someone that showed me how to apply domain-driven design. Fortunately, I started to use domain-driven design in many projects and environments. My company works for financial, industry, and insurance, many different markets, many different environments. And the way to apply domain-driven design, it's offered to me these opportunities to try to apply domain-driven design from scratch in a greenfield situation or a brownfield when you have to deal with a refactor. That's the goal of our book.
Well, excellent. I see you segued into domain-driven design from different angles.
Yeah.
And obviously, the two of you have collaborated a lot. And it's always, for me, a great treat to join your workshops. And the way you teach feels like watching sort of a, what should I say, a kitchen conversation between a married couple with a shared brain, but still a lot of small disagreements.
Yeah.
So I'm curious, what made you, you know, start collaborating together? What's good about it? And how did you, you know, end up writing a book together? Was there a key moment sort of that sort of sparked the idea that you said, yeah, this is it, we're going for it, and together?
We started, I think, thinking about a book 5 years ago. I think we start talking about the possibility of writing a book and the first ideas in front of a beer, because of course our most interesting and challenging conversations happens with a beer, of course. I think we started talking about 5 years ago. Then 3 years ago, 2 years ago, if I'm not mistaken, we tried writing our own, but because of work and life in general, we weren't able to achieve something concrete. And then we had this coincidence with a pactor that contacted us and asked if we were willing to write a book on refactoring. And all the dots connected, because we were already maturing some ideas on refactoring. We did already lots of workshops on refactoring, handling legacy code. And it just came up as a natural evolution of our path in the refactoring. And so it was a coincidence. We didn't look for it especially one day. It's something that we talked about over the years and doing workshops, etc. And then the opportunity of the book came and we took it as fast as possible.
So the idea emerged and then the stars aligned for you and it just it happened. I've heard from a lot of book authors that you know, writing a book is hard work and it's not a walk in the park.
Yeah.
And like you already mentioned, there are already many DDD books around out there. Why did you feel another DDD book was needed? What was the gap you were filling? Who is it for?
Oh,
go Alberto,
you're right.
Be politically correct.
There are plenty of excellent domain-driven design books available, but at least for us, all these books don't start from the standpoint of refactoring. They see domain-driven design, how to apply domain-driven design from beginning for your project, how to apply domain-driven design when you start a new project, and they explain you the patterns and all the situation that you can find when you're starting a project using this pattern. The idea for us was, okay, we work a lot of refactored mode. Customer comes to us asking, oh, we have this application that we use a lot because it's very valuable for us, but this is old. No one that started application working with us now. In this moment and many of these common situation and the starting point is a bit different to, okay, I can apply domain-driven design because this is a new project. This is not a new project. This is something that exists with its history and you have to explore the history before to apply domain-driven design. That was our idea.
Right. So a really tough use case is sitting with a brownfield project needing to. Yeah.
You can do it.
And obviously your book is named A Hands-On Guide. So you showed people hands-on step by step how to do this, right?
Yeah. Because that we did every day.
Yes. So now let's dive into the core of the book. I think our listeners and viewers are eager to do this as well. And for me, the core of this book is really to say that DDD is super relevant in brownfield and in these refactoring contexts, which is obviously also the name of your book, Domain-Driven Refactoring. So to begin with, let's unpack what domain-driven means, right? You know, if a domain is kind of a business area supported by some good software, then domain-driven could mean just business-driven. or business requirements driven. And many companies have these requirements disciplines, product owners and writing stories and so forth. So tell us, what's the difference between requirements driven and domain driven? And why does this distinction matter in the context of refactoring?
Okay, I think that the main distinctions that comes to mind right now is that requirements driven tends to be more static and linear. You gather the list of needs and then you have to translate these needs into features, you know. So it focuses on what the system should do and not why those features need to exist. And so with domain-driven design, you have a different approach because you are, at least for a refactoring standpoint, you are continuously refining your understanding with the developer and domain expert, your understanding of the business flow, the business process, and using ubiquitous language, bounded context, strategic pattern, you are modeling the deep structure of the business, the logic behind it. So you have a knowledge completely different, and you, of course, act and change your monolith in a different way because you're not just adding features without thinking. Okay, you have to understand what's the deep understanding. You have to have the deep understanding of the domain, and so you act accordingly. So I think that yes. The main difference.
Yeah. So starting even in brownfield, even in refactoring, let's start with the why. Not just the what and the how. So basically, that's what I took away. And that harmonizes very well with this path a lot of teams are on, from, you know, pure requirements or feature teams to product teams owning the business outcome, that sort of thing.
Requirements are the solution. That you come to me and ask me to solve the problem and you offer me a solution. No, you ask me and you explore me the problem and me and you together find a solution, not you propose me a solution with your requirements. It's quite different.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I think this position could be a little bit surprising for some people when they hear the word refactoring, because when some developers hear refactoring, they think about clean code, clean up the code, right? And you used a big portion of your book to talk about problem space, even complexity, Kinevan, and so speak to the developers. What are some of the concrete payoffs to, you know, start with the problem space compared to jumping straight into code analysis and code cleanup and that sort of thing?
Yes. Refactoring is not just rebuild your solution or modernize your solution using new technology, new framework, and new language patterns. It's something incremental. We love the incremental refactoring. We're starting with analyze your domain, your problem. Then, from a technical point of view, what are the first steps that you have to do before to analyze and modify your code? And to do this, we have to understand your problem. I'm a developer. I'm an expert in my field, not in your. I'm not a broker in financial market. I'm not an expert in industrial market, in IoT fields. First, I have to meet your problem, your desiderata, and you're starting to analyze your legacy code, find the right boundaries, because without splitting your solution, I cannot modify nothing in your code, or at least I cannot without the fear to introduce new bug, new something that goes wrong. So refactor is not just, I destroy the old code and rewrite the code. I have to understand and with baby step move forward and change something, introduce the pattern of domain-driven design and context mapping, ubiquitous language, and all these patterns are fundamental for the first part of the refactoring code. then you can apply all the other patterns, aggregate, and if you want, event-driven, CQRS, and so on. But fundamental part is understand the problem, analyze the problem. We use Delusion Walk or something that I love because we are Italian, as Michelangelo told when... do you know the Mosè statua, Dio? Did you know?
Yeah.
When he finished this opera, the people asked them, how do you extract from the marble of this beautiful opera? And so, but the Mosè or the Angelo, whatever the opera that you want, or Michelangelo, it was in the marble and I carved until I set it free. So the same is for the legacy code. The solution is in the legacy code, because if you ask me to refactor your code because you use that legacy code, because it's valuable for you, you just need to extract the fundamental part and move forward.
And I will add just another thing that we see lots of time, both me and Alberto, is that legacy is not just because the system is old.
No.
There is often this long lost knowledge, and that's why you have to understand why he does the thing he does. What were the choices that were made during the life of this system? Because it's not just old. It has lots of caveats that you have to understand before changing things, like said Alberto.
That is a very important perspective, isn't it? That the code legacy is just not old.
It's not just old. At least it's not just old. Just because it is old, you have to change it. No. Mm. There are many other aspects that brings you to choose to change and go down this rabbit hole, open this rabbit hole.
Right. I totally resonate with, you know, this image, like, let's say the legacy code is a big chunk of marble. Okay, what does it do? And then how do you see the David? That masculine figure, you know, with the essence of the code. So that is what we want to do with the first step of refactoring. But then, you know, the challenge is that for me, there's in legacy system, there's often this language drift. We all know this, and some concepts become muddy, become overlapping, become conflicting. But then the challenge is really, because you have worked with this for so long, it becomes everybody's everyday. And so in your view, how can people begin to notice these gaps? How can people begin to notice that my marble is starting to morph from this beautiful figure towards something else? And if we don't take care, one day we may not even recognize what the figure is supposed to be. How do we create this kind of awareness that invites people to question continuously, do we have these leaky legacy abstractions that, you know, that we've taken for granted? How do we do this?
Okay, I think that there are tools that help you to understand the business flows, and like event storming, that help you to have try to map. You have this legacy, you don't know anything, or you don't know a lot of it. You have to start to mapping the business processes, and I think that event storming is the perfect tool, because you don't delve into the technical stuff. You just understand how things works, how the information goes around your system, and how the system is supposed to react to this kind of information and the interaction of your user. From them, you have a high view of everything, and then you can start defining about that context, try to understand the ubiquitous language of every part of the system. And at least for me, I can already see some lines creating, and I already see some boundaries, and from them I explore and see if it is okay with the team and the overlapping parts, and then you have the discussion of every single things that emerge from that. But usually I start with the event storming.
Great.
Yeah. When I was a student, my software engineer professor frequently told us, oh, writing the code is the last action that you have to do when you create a new application. I hated him because at the time, I want to write code because I discovered this fantastic way to express myself and I want to write code. And probably he was right and 50%, 80%, because it's true, writing the code is the last action, but when you work with a legacy code, we have to understand the problem, as Alessandro said, so you have to use brainstorming or all these tools, but also offer to your customer a solution in a short time. So using this technical baby step, you can refactor your code, show the result in, I don't know, three sprint, not 6 months, 5 months, 8 months, 1 year. And at the same time, you continue this conversation with your customer to understand the problem. Probably this
That's
is
right.
the real, yes.
Hmm. I think what the two of you have pointed out is really encouraging for, you know, software engineers and developers to see that what is our real power? Is it to implement a story? Is it to implement the newest patterns? Is it to do vibe programming with AI? Or is it to solve some problems worth solving? And how do we even get to the problem? Well, it's hard work. It requires, like Alessandro, you said, it requires a discovery process,
yes,
using event storming, and we need to get
iterate.
The language right.
So it's an iteration, a continuous iteration.
Yes. But when that happens, it actually, like the complexity of the business problem merges with our problem solving skills, and something beautiful and powerful emerges out of that process. And that's what we are in the world to do, right? That's our contribution to the world, rather than, you know, writing implementation of someone else's specification, which is done maybe 3 months ago and already deviated from the reality. So, and what you're telling the community is that there are tools and there are techniques that can help us do this in a step-by-step way. It's not an unconquerable piece of marble. We are not Michelangelo. No, we don't have to be Michelangelo to do this piece. That's what I hear you say.
Yeah.
Right. Let's directly jump to, you know, you mentioned different levels of refactoring in your book. Mm-hmm. Let's jump to the biggest granularity level, architecture refactoring. I think a lot of people are curious to know, you know, for years, microservices sort of have been seen as the end game of the architecture nirvana or architecture modernization. And unfortunately, you know, many people, teams have tried this, but ended up with a kind of a distributed big ball of mud. So from your perspective, how can a team realistically assess, you know, whether they're actually ready for microservices, or maybe even take a step back? And how do we know if even do we need microservices? What's your take on this?
Yeah, probably the first request of a new customer proposes, oh, I need to transform my legacy code in a microsystem solution because, we have to refactor the code and the microservices are the solution for all our problems. But it's very hard to create a microservice architecture starting from something like a big ball of mud. So, like Michelangelo will create was starting from a big block of marble. So microservices is like, it's very cool. So we have to, I need to have the last solution that the market proposed because we have the top of the world in our sector and we need to have the top of the world in our architecture solution. But first you have to understand what are the problems that your solution want to solve? Then split the solution in the right boundary and recreate a monolith solution, but a well-organized, well-structured monolith solution. So modular monolith, for example, as we expose in our book. But it's not because we don't like microservices, or we hate monolith, or we love monolith. it's the way that you write your code that made a difference, not the architect that you choose. Because you don't choose microservices, your solution is not the best solution that you can propose to me. No. If really you need microservices because, I don't know, your web portal, your basket for e-commerce grows a lot, you have a lot of requests because it's Black Friday, because it's the Christmas Eve and so on. If you really need to scale part of your solution and the other, no, probably you need to move your architecture microservices. But if you're public, if who use your solution is your colleagues, the employees of a company and so on, and you have 100, 200, 1,000 users of your application, and you use a virtual machine or a server on your basement, you don't need really a microservices solution. A well-organized monolith that we can modify and explore and evolve as you want is the best solution, at least for us. We, as Alessandro and I say, we haven't the solution.
Yeah, we have just ours.
It's our solution.
I think that the teams that need to choose if moving for a microservice solution, I think they can ask themselves two questions maybe. Are we technically ready for that? And are we organizationally ready for that? Because if I have to split my monolith in microservices and the teams doesn't have the full controls end-to-end on a service, on a new service, it could be a problem.
What do you mean by that? What is organizationally ready for you?
For me, the team must be autonomous over the service that you have to manage. And also, from organizationally, you have also to be, the team must be business aligned. It's not just a technical stuff, because the technical stuff is already hard because you have network latency, eventual consistency, communication patterns that changes because it's way easier to have communication inside our modules, inside the monolith, instead of having distributed services around the globe or also in the same server farm. they are decoupled, etc. But we tend to oversee the organizational stuff. Because I have to be autonomous, I have to be in control of my service. And the business must be aligned between bounded contexts, because every service represents a bounded context, and the teams working on them have to be perfectly aligned.
Mm-hmm.
This is also a challenge, because it's not always easy to do that.
Mm. And that's right. And that's why in your book, you sort of mentioned the modular monolith as a fair sort of a stepping stone or architectural waypoint to get to the microservices if you really need it in the end. I guess from a domain-driven perspective, a modular monolith, the modularity part is really giving us the boundaries and the understandability of the code, making it easier to transition to the next step, right?
Yes. And it allows you to explain the seams of your application. If you are not able to explain how things works, how things are connected, you can, of course, you can move to a microservices and increment the complexity. So it's better to have a really well-made monolith.
Yeah.
And then it will be much more easier to move to a microservices because you have already independent modules inside your monolith. So it's way easier to bring a module and transform it in an independent outside service. And you can do this one step at a time. We always say, we always repeat the same things, baby steps, baby steps, baby steps.
But also if you remain in your monolith solution, if you receive a request for a new feature in a sales module, it's much easier to implement this feature because you have to work just on this independent module inside your monolith. You don't have coupling with the other modules. So introduce new feature in your solution is easy. It's not so hard. It's not difficult. Yeah. It's not impossible.
Mm. Plus, if you took another Deloitte walk and got cold feet about your boundaries. It's way easier to change a modular monolith than if you already split into 10,000 microservices and you, it's difficult to rework that piece, right?
Yeah.
It's kind of postponing the important decisions to the last responsible moment in a way.
Yes,
also.
And also, as Martin Fowler said, the only thing a Big Bang rewrite guarantees is a Big Bang. And I think Martin Fowler said that.
Right, right. So another, you know, Big Bang kind of a big topic in a way is that I've seen, you know, financial institutions, a lot of big organizations having a kind of an API movement. A lot of the legacy functionalities, capabilities have been API enabled. And the next step for a lot of these organizations is kind of to move toward a more event-driven kind of architecture. And could you unpack this piece? How would domain-driven thinking help companies better position themselves on this path from the API enablement to a more, you know, large-scale event-driven architecture?
Well, first of all, you can apply domain-driven design without forcing your code to use event-driven architecture because many developers think, oh, if I implement domain-driven design, I have to know event-driven architecture. No, you can apply domain-driven design without event-driven architecture. For sure, in a modern infrastructure, because we deploy on cloud mostly of the time and using different services that communicate between them, like Alessandro said, we need to use a different pattern to communicate between these services, these microservices, and event-driven is a good way because it guarantees the decoupling of the services, but introduce new problem. You have to deal with eventual consistency. You have to deal with separate database with each microservice. Each service, don't use microservices, has to have the whole database. It's impossible to have more microservices, more than one microservice that use the same database because it's not a microservice solution.
It's a distributed
It's another solution. It's possible to create a solution with a unit database and more services, but it's not microservices. It's another kind of solution. All of these combination of pros and cons that are to evaluate before to move to microservices, to event-driven architecture. Event-driven architecture is one of my favorite for sure, but it introduces a new knowledge in your company. Do you know how to manage this kind of problem? Do you know how to manage eventual consistency? Do you know the difference of messages that live in your microservices and messages that live outside your microservices? These are totally different messages with totally different scope, that with totally different meaning. They contain different informations, and that's very, very important. A domain event is not the same as integration event. Are two different events, okay? From the technical point of view, are classes with immutable property, but the content of one is different than the content of the second one. So please move to microservices when you really knows all these, I can say, small but important differences. That seems small, but it's not so small. It's small from, I repeat, technical point of view, but not from a business point of view.
So, and also, I would say, use it where it really matters.
Yeah.
Because if you have real bottlenecks in some places of your application, it makes sense to move to events. For example, for reporting that or a huge task, you can use events. But if your system works perfectly fine with an API, with a synchronous API, and it works fine, why change it? If there is no value in it, as Alberto was saying, just who was a Neil Ford, the developer attracted
yeah.
to new technology like moth to flames, and usually they end up in the same way.
Right, right. So we really need to distinguish between the essential kind of business complexity compared with our fascination with tooling complexity, with patterns and so forth. That brings me to one of the more subtle points you made in the book. There is a graph in your book, sort of about code complexity, you know, how inexperienced developers write easy code, while experienced developers do not write complex code, but they aim for simple code, which isn't always easy to write. What do you mean by that?
This is for Alberto because I leave the Alberto. This is yours.
when you over the your college university path and you start into introduce yourself in the work mode. Okay, now I'm employed in a big company, and you know a lot of patterns. Oh, you want to apply all this pattern? Oh, I knew this pattern. I have to apply this pattern in my code. Oh, a new pattern that Alessandro taught me. Oh, I have to apply this pattern. And if you paint a curve in a graph, you can see the curve that up with a very height increasing very, very high. When the time that you spend working on code increase, you discover that you have to apply the right pattern at the right moment, not all pattern together, but the right pattern when you really need to use that pattern, and your curve starting to decrease. And at the beginning, you are in the easy way. That's not simple. The easy way is the best way to create a big ball of mud, because you introduce all the pattern, all what you learn at the first time that you work. At the end of your path, of the year curve, you are in the simple way, when you apply just the right pattern and introduce new feature, modify the structure, modify whatever you want, is easy. It's simple. Sorry, not easy, simple. But create something that's simple is not easy. At least.
That's right. Yeah, I guess what you're also saying that it's, we've all been there. We've all gone from writing naive code and then, oh, being totally in love with all these patterns and architecture.
We have to use them.
You know, naming. Yeah, we have to use them. And then at a point in our career, we will realize that simple is better. It's simple is not naive. Simple is actually that option that gives us adaptability, a change, and all this. So it's okay. We've all been there. So get ready on your own path, right?
Yeah.
Right. So we've kind of covered a lot of ground already. Before we wrap up this episode, let's turn the spotlight back to the two of you. So where can people follow your work and connect with you, Alessandro and Alberto?
On LinkedIn.
We usually share
everything on LinkedIn. We are not social people, I would say.
LinkedIn it is.
On LinkedIn. And we have our repo on GitHub,
LinkedIn or on the top of some mountains.
Yeah, on the mountains.
Yeah. And the code repo, the link is in the book.
Absolutely, yes.
Okay, great.
And then we have also another repo that we have all the example codes that we use in our workshops, our experiments, and everything is inside there, so you can take a look. I will share it in the...
We will definitely include that in the show notes.
Yeah.
So what's the next chapter for the two of you? Any new experiments, workshops, or collaborations on the horizon?
Yeah, we started working, of course, on AI. We are trying to create something with AI to help developers in understanding domain-driven design, understanding bounded context, and trying to move from event storming to something that makes sense in a code point of view. We are working on that. So, because AI can write code, yes, of course. But how about understanding bounded context? How about understanding the correct domain event to use? And so we are experimenting with it to try if we will be able to create something that can help us moving faster, or at least that can give us some tips
to work to understand the domain, because the AI, at least in my opinion right now, isn't able to do that, because every domain is different. Every problem has a different solution because the variables in place are different. So you can't rely on the AI because it seems the same problem that I had the last time. So, okay, I will reuse the same code, it's the same things. So we are experimenting on that. And we are thinking about another book, but...
Fascinating. Let me know when you're running the first workshop. I will be your...
For sure.
I'm willing to be your guinea pig. That one. Okay. I guess this will be the last question. Is there anything we didn't cover today that you might want to add, or any final thoughts you want to leave our listeners or viewers with?
Don't be lazy with domain events and integration events.
Yeah,
because they are not the same thing.
Don't be lazy.
So don't be lazy.
They are not the same thing.
Don't be lazy in general. Don't be lazy.
Yeah, that's a good cliffhanger. If you don't know the distinction between integration events and domain events, as Alberto have already mentioned once, go and check out in the book. And don't be lazy. All right. So, what about you, Alberto? You have something to say?
No, don't be lazy. It's my
sum it up.
Okay, say parola d'ordine. I don't know in English. Sorry. the must that I to follow to improve yourself in general. So don't be lazy. It's for sure great. The best way to close in this. Starting.
Yeah, that's a great closing punchline. Don't be lazy. And that will be a wrap for today's GoTo Book Club. Alessandro, Alberto, thank you so much for sharing your stories and insights. I've definitely felt your AA energy also today, all the way through. And to our viewers and listeners, if you're listening to this in your car, in the train, during a walk, or on a run, if this episode sparked any new ideas about refactoring or about DDD, we hope you'll carry this curiosity forward and consider maybe adding domain-driven refactoring to your summer reading list. Maybe you'll find links to the books, code examples, repos, and where to follow these two amazing people in the show notes below. And I guess that's all, folks, and see you next time.
Thank you. Bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the GoTo Podcast. Head over to gotopia.tech to discover lots more content from the brightest minds in software development.